As you can tell, we're doing things a bit differently today, which is good. I recall years ago we were doing a pastor's conference up in Canada, and I got into the church, and the pastor had taken a sabbatical, and he'd been gone for months, and lo and behold, he gets back, and his first Sunday back, they had me booked to speak, and the man was aching to preach. So, see, I've been gone for a week, and I can't wait long enough, so therefore they're going to let me on early. I want to talk to you today from Psalm 26. Psalm 126, if you'll turn there with me, please. It is interesting because as we face these days, many of you are facing difficult times physically. And because of that, there are great pressures upon you. Others are facing difficult times financially, and you find yourself crying out to God to somehow bring resolution to this. Others of you are facing trials emotionally, and at a time like that, you find yourself crying out to God, seeing if somehow he can bring resolution to that which aches so deep within you. And it's to those issues that we come today, not only for the life of us as individuals, but for thus as a church body. And I would have you come to this passage. It's interesting because it has been my practice over the years, and for 40 years, of when I read in the morning, beginning in the book of Psalms, it is always the place of beginning for me. Actually, I start in two places. I start in Psalm 119, first of all, to prepare my heart for the word. And then after that, I go to another psalm to prepare my heart for worship and praise. Then I make my way to the Proverbs, and then from there to the reading I do in the Old and New Testament. But the interesting part of this, this psalm I have read over and over and over again, as you can figure, over the many years. My first acquaintance with this psalm, in reality, was in my first year at Biola. We had to take a course in evangelism, and the course in evangelism meant we memorized a lot of verses out of context. And this was one of them. And so therefore, we did this one. And it was verse 5, those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro, weeping, carrying his bag of seed, shall indeed come again with shout of joy, bring his sheaves with him. And I'm sure then we get our songs, bringing the sheaves, they shall come rejoicing. Now, actually, by application, it certainly applies to that, but for years, you see, because I memorized it out of this context, I thought maybe that's what it was about, but as I read the passage, that's not at all what it's about. So let me do it today. You can apply it to evangelism. You can apply it to a whole bunch of things in life, if you will, but it is a great psalm. It is part, if you will even look in your text, it's part of 15 psalms that are songs of ascent. You start back, if you will, if you have titles over yours, you notice in Psalm 120, it's a song of ascent, Psalm 21, a song of ascent, and so forth, and it just keeps going through this section. What is a song of ascent? As they went to worship, some would suggest, and those of you who sat in the temple area and seen the steps going up into the temple in Jerusalem, some would suggest it's those steps that they climb, and at each step the Levites would sing one of these songs. I would choose, with many others, although none of us know exactly, but I would choose to think that what happens is if you sit on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and you look out, you see that for miles and miles and miles around you can see the temple. There were three of the pilgrimage feasts, as they're called, where the children of Israel would come up to Jerusalem to worship. And as they were walking toward Jerusalem from a distance, they could see the Temple Mount. And it would seem that they would sing these songs in anticipation of the worship that they were going to experience that day. Now, that's not what they were written for necessarily, but that's what they were used for. Now, in order to understand any psalm, what's important is to understand the context in which it is written. And certainly in this one, there is a significant one because it is addressed to us. It's a song of thanksgiving, as it says in the bold print under mine, for return from captivity. It certainly was that. What happened was, the historical setting, the children of Israel had been led out of the land of captivity, and they were now returning, and this is a song that they sang. Now, you know, it's intriguing to me, by the way. If any of you know, Jewish people, Israelitish people, love to sing. Some years back, I was invited to speak at a conference. It was a last-minute thing because the speaker had hurt his back, and it was Jewish believers gathering together up at Lake Arrowhead. And my, could they sing. Oh, could they sing. It's fun to hear them sing. They love to sing. And they loved, as you see, even from the book of Psalms, Psalms is only reflective of that, they loved to write songs. And by the way, I have a feeling that is really how the church began as well. If you read 1 Corinthians 14, it says each has a song. And so when they came to church, there was that, if you will, the anticipation of participation. And people, they wrote songs of expression of love and adoration to God. I wonder today if maybe in the midst of all that we've done to structure the church, we've somehow structured out this spontaneity of people to write songs of praise and worship to God, as you see expressed here in Psalm 126 and all of the Psalms for that matter. Now, as you look at this, it's interesting because the song is an exciting psalm. In fact, people have a problem because the first three verses are so exciting. The last few verses are rather difficult in a sense to put in perspective, but really they're not that bad after all. But let me talk to you about this just for a moment. The children of Israel are coming out of a captivity. Now, if you think about this for a moment before we even look at the song, do you understand that the problem with the children of Israel is that they had never learned, as we have trouble learning, a life of dependence upon God? They hadn't. I mean, why did it even happen that you see, as they come out of the land of Egypt and they're walking as they are like that, they just did not learn dependence upon God. They hadn't learned dependence before that. You understand why they went into captivity? When they come out of Egypt, they came to the land of Canaan, and God had provided step by step. The clothes hadn't worn out. The food was there every day. The manna was there. When they came to the land God provided, they'd seen God's provision. There's no doubt. And you and I have seen God's provision. We as a church body. I say that wherever I go. And I will reflect on it later as well. I have never, in all of my years of ministry, you understand, 40 years next month, I was called to pastor a church six blocks from here. In all of these 40 years, I have never been a part of anything as exciting as this body is exciting to me. That's a fact. That's not because I'm here. I say it everywhere I go, and I come back here to say it. And the other thing that's exciting about this is that we all know it is God who made happen what's happened here. We all know that. None of us is individual or even corporately responsible for what's happened here. God designed it. God made it happen. God has provided. And we sit here at this point understanding God's provision. They did. And yet, they came into the land and God says, okay, now, what I need you to do, and this is something I'm asking you to do, is every 7 years you let the land lie fallow. Now, the trouble from just a rational point of view is how in the world do you provide for your family when, in fact, you don't go out there and till the ground and prepare the ground and plant the crops and so forth? How in the world can you provide for your family? See, we have trouble when God calls on us to do things that cause us to depend upon Him. Somehow we've seen God's provision, but we can't accept God's conditions. For 490 years, they had failed to let the land lie fallow. So now God, at this point in time, sends them out. And they're going to go in captivity 70 years, 1 year for every year they'd failed to let the land lie fallow, for every year they'd failed to depend upon God. So if they find themselves in this time of calamity only because of their own doing, and it just stopped with me for a bit, before we just look at Israel, we think about ourselves for a while. The things that we cry out to God to deliver us from, are they not so often the things that we have created, the mess that we've created for ourselves? Because of an unwillingness to depend upon God, we've created the mess. Now we really get so deep and we cry out to God and say, God, we're in a terrible strait. We need your help. That's where they were, by the way. But now God delivers them. And they make the statement, the very first part of the psalm, when the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion. See, now we've been released and God's letting us go back to the land again. And for 70 years, we have been waiting to go back. For 70 years, we've talked about how it was back in the old homestead. For 70 years, we've wished we could be back where we used to be. Now, finally, God lets us go. And look at the statement that he makes. He says, we were like those who dream. You know, you've been there, right? All of a sudden, God does something, and you stop, and you can't even believe it. You think you're dreaming, and you say, don't pinch me, I'm afraid I'll wake up. You see, somehow, you look at this, and you recognize that God has done something, but after 70 years of being in captivity, you can't hardly believe that God has done what you were hoping and praying that God would do. You know, it's interesting, even as you look at, I think of the case of Peter in Acts when they prayed for his deliverance and then he showed up at the door and they didn't even believe it was he, and he's standing right there. And even took a bit for him to realize when the angel was delivering him that this is for real. So they said, we thought it was a dream. But then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting. You know, it's exciting because there's an exuberance. There's an excitement to this. But by the way, turn with me a few psalms over to Psalm 137. For a group of people that love to sing and that love to rejoice and love to praise God, or just before this, there was no way they could. Notice by the rivers of Babylon, just before our release, we sat down and wept, Psalm 137, when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. I mean, they had the instruments for music, but there was no music. And there our captors demanded of a song. See, even unsaved people love to hear Jewish people sing. And they demanded of songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. But oh, how, verse 4, can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. And so they find themselves in captivity, weeping instead of singing. And now, for the first time in years, God's released them to a song of mirth, to a song of joy. Do you know what is so difficult in my mind when it comes to worship? It is true. We came here this morning, we sing songs of praise. Sometimes we're so lethargic. Sometimes we're just going through the motions. Somehow we lose the exuberance of a relationship with God. I mean, there are people who love, in fact, I remember somebody says, the reason I went to another church, I didn't agree with their doctrine, but I love the way they worship, and I love the fact that they really had a concern and care for people. Now, you know what? We could become exuberant in our expression of love for God, and we should become exuberant in our love and care for God. These were people who, so excited by what God had done, they're released to praise and worship and adoration of God. And so, but now notice what happens here. Not only do they do this, but notice, he says, not only did we do this, but notice something else. Even, he says, the ungodly. Look at, they even among the nations, they said the Lord has done great things for them. You know what's exciting is when you realize that God has done great things in your life, that is exciting. But when other people looking at you can sense that God is doing great things, that is even more exciting. And so much so that it causes them at this point to cry out and say, look at the latter part of that verse, the Lord has done great things for us, we are glad. It is a great thing when you stop and reflect on all that God has done in your life, and others look at you and begin to reflect on all that God has done in your life, and everybody understands it's the hand of God. Now, before we move any further, the reminder for all of us is this. Whatever blessings we have, God gave them to us. I mean, if there's anything about verses 1 to 3, it's to recognize that if, in fact, there is any blessing, if, in fact, there is anything that you are excited about in your life, understand that those things are things that God has given to you. They're not things that we earned. They're not things we deserve. They're things that God in His grace has showered upon us. And so we sing those songs of praise to God. Praise God from whom? What? All blessings flow. So the beginning of this psalm is exciting because there is an exuberance, there is a worship, there is a praise, there is a spontaneity that had not been there before, but all of a sudden when God begins to do what they prayed that God would do for so long, they rejoice in praise and worship to God. But now, the tough part comes in verse 4, for some have trouble with this. They think that the first part is futuristic, is not what God has done, but it is. And the point being made is so incredible because all of a sudden he moves from praise to prayer. And he makes a statement here. He says, "Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the Negev." Now, it's true, it's translated in the south. It is the Negev. The Negev, if you know, is that if you've got Palestine up here, you've got Egypt down here, you've got that body of desert between called the Negev, and it was awful hot and it was awfully dry. Now, it is interesting because what happens is, and it will come to play later as we look at this passage. I grew up with this in Africa. It's not in the Negev, but it was similar things. You know, when it talks about the early and latter rain, you understand that because what happens is you have dry season, and for months on end, there is no rain, none. The land is dry. The water is drying up. You build dams if you can to try to find water. It's interesting, on a Sunday morning, we're sitting in here. We take so much for granted. If this was where I worshiped for many years in Africa, you would see the women coming into church late. They would have left at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning with these pots on their heads. They would have walked so far for water, and what they did is they'd get the water and fill the pots up, and they'd carry these pots back on their heads. And it took them that long to go out and find water and get back and get it to the house and then get dressed and get to church on time. You see, and it's interesting, by the way, it is fascinating. During dry season, there's very little water. And it's interesting, in Russia, they talked about some people who got to save and wanted to be baptized immediately. It was middle of winter. And they said, "Can't you wait?" And they said, "No, we'll do it right away." They said, "How about waiting until it gets a little warmer?" "No." And we have the pictures of them walking across the ice. They broke a hole in the ice, and then they had to put a pole into the ground because the current was so much. They afraid it would, wipe them away like that. And so here they climbed down into here, and the pastor baptized them. Well, in Africa, we didn't have that problem. We had the other problem: there was no water. So they asked a friend of ours to go out and baptize for them, and they said, "What the deal is?" They had these great big, huge drums that they use for gas or petrol, and they fill this thing full of water, and the thing was to push this person down inside of this. They said, "Is that okay?" And he said, "Absolutely, see, because you can't, there's no water in the river, so you get as much water as you can in this." So he got there, and there were two of these drums side by side. He said, "What's this?" They said, "We want to do it right, so you have to climb into the one barrel of water and push him down in the other." So you see, we're going to do it right. We, at many times during that time of the year, you are allowed one bucket of person, one bucket of water. That was for bathing, flushing, whatever you wanted to do with that bucket of water per day. You see, for months there is no rain. Then all of a sudden, what's interesting, I can remember still, I'd be out playing tennis and you'd feel the wind coming and you knew the time had come. Wait till the last minute and I get on the motorbike and head for home. And first of all, get it inside, and then with my wife, we were on the edge of a cliff and we would go to every window and take towels and sheets and whatever and pack them into the windows because it was a ferocious wind and it was a driving rainstorm. The early rains were harsh rains. Now, it's interesting because in anticipation of those early rains, you would know when they were supposed to come. I'll never forget watching on the news one time when the Sahara was moving south and in a country called Niger. They were talking to some people. Now, you understand, you don't go buy seed in the store. When you raise a crop, you take a portion of the seed and put it aside for eating and a portion of it for trading with somebody else to get something that they have that you don't have. And a portion of it you set aside that you would never touch for anything because you're going to use that to plant. And if you don't have any seed to plant, there's not a store to go buy it from. So now what you do, the story was some Muslims and it was hot like this, and they're talking to a newsman and they took the last of their seed and were putting in the ground and they said, now it's up to Allah. You see, if you plant and the water doesn't come, then you have nothing that you can do to start to get this germinated. So what would happen anyhow, they would prepare the mounds ahead of time. They would plant into those mounds and they waited for these ferocious winds and storms to come. And the initial rain was a harsh rain. It was a heavy rain. It was a penetrating rain. It was what the land needed after months and months and months of no rain. God designed it that way, called in the Bible the early rains. The latter rains are rains of just a mist. They're not the heavy rains. And in fact, I do remember preaching in a church and looking out, and the pastor lived next door, and you looked out at his crop that was behind his house and it was lying flat because God had designed that year that this latter rain would not be a soft rain. It was a harsh rain, and it destroyed his crops. We were back doing Bill Brandenstein's, Bill's wedding in Colorado some years ago. And I remember leaving the practice. We were in the practice, and they says, everybody better get out of here and get home if you want to get home tonight. So Perlina Scott and I got in the car, and we began driving. You couldn't even see the road for the rain like that, but there was a massive storm coming through, and it was the best year of wheat that they had in years and years and years. It's interesting, Scott was praying as we drive that God would keep the rain from coming onto where they were, and God stopped the rain, the hail 10 miles away. But you see much of the crop destroyed. See, what you want is the lighter rain at the end, not the heavy rains. But you see here, they're waiting for some rain to come in the Negev, as dry and hot and arid as it is, when in fact these rains start, there are massive streams that now start flowing through the Negev that will not last very long, but they are there for a while. And now this psalmist moves from praise to crying out to God to saying to God, will you please restore our captivity? You say, well, I thought you were out of captivity. He says, restore our captivity like the streams of the rivers of the Negev. What is this about? What is interesting is the fact that you see what they realized as they came out of the land was this. You have been in the land for years, and you come back again out of captivity. Now, it's interesting, by the way, if you think about this for a bit. The first time they came to the land of Canaan, it was incredible because they'd had manna one day, and the next day there is none. And the reason for this was because you had people in the land who were living on the land, who were growing crops on the land. So when you drove them out of the land, the food was there, and they didn't need the provision of God. But this time is different. All of that excitement, You're coming back. You remember, you're walking, okay? You're walking back with your children, and they've listened to the story. They've listened to Grandma and Grandpa talk about the homestead and how nice the house was and how they had this great place with trees growing and how the crops were growing, and they came back 70 years. Nobody cared for the land. Now, think about that for a bit. 70 years, nobody took the rocks away. 70 years, nobody tilled the soil. 70 years, nobody planted anything. It was worse when you came back from captivity than when you first came into the land of Canaan. Now think about this for a moment. See, there's no store to go buy food from. You understand that, see? So therefore, you see, you come back into the land, and your difficulty is that all of a sudden you need food for the family, but there is no food. Nobody has tilled the soil for 70 years. And the anticipation and the excitement you felt, all of a sudden you walk onto where you used to live, and it isn't what you thought it would be. And the grandkids had heard the stories for years. They looked and said, "This is what we were looking forward to?" Now you understand that even if you decide that you want to grow this, you can't just, you know, turn on a tap and water this thing and grow your tomatoes. You can't do that. You're going to have to wait until the rainy season comes. You're going to have to wait until God provides a way. And you see, you're going to have to wait for all the months it takes to till the soil, to plant the seed, to wait for the early rain, to wait for the latter rain, to see the harvest take place. And you're going to have to wait, and you're going to have to go without food for that many years. There's an unbelievable principle here. Every time you find a time of release in your life where God has released you from some kind of bondage or difficulty, He leads you into a new place of dependence and need. He does. You think about it for a while, okay? Children of Israel... I mean, just from a biblical point of view, children of Israel had so longed to get out of the land of Egypt that when they got out of the land of Egypt, they were all excited. Did they anticipate 40 years of walking through a wilderness? Did they anticipate the fact that they come to the Red Sea and the waters are there? Did they anticipate bitter waters, no water? Did they anticipate the fact that there would be the enemies that attacked them? No, you see, God moved them from one place of dependence to another. And God does that. Oh, even when they crossed the Jordan and came into the land, and the euphoria that came when they saw Jericho conquered, and they saw after the defeated Ai, they saw God resume this fighting for them and causing victory, and they thought, you know, this is great. We've come into the land. We've got a land flowing with milk and honey. Did they realize they'd have to drive out enemy after enemy after enemy for years and begin to solidify their position within the land? No. Nor when they sat in the land of Babylon and cried out to God for deliverance, did they ever anticipate it would be so hard when they came back again. For all of us, life is that way, my friend. It's not just about the Bible, it's about life. It's about a child who is graduating from... Well, no, that's not a child anymore. Let me go with that. Okay, it's all right. We can do a child graduating from high school. A young person. Okay, let's take it to young man or woman graduating from college. We'll make it that way, all right? And you graduate from there, and you've worked so hard. You've gone through high school. You've gone through college. You think, this is great. I can get out now. I'm free. And then all of a sudden, you step out into the real world of having to earn a living and carry on life, and you begin to see, this is what I was looking forward to. Or you're young. And you long so much to be married. And then all of a sudden, God brings that delightful person into your life, and you cannot wait. I'll never forget. It was the only time I asked God to withhold the rapture. I did. He didn't do it just for that, but I said, you know what, just let me get married first, okay, please. I did ask that. That's how carnal life was back then. But you see, I did long to be married to her. And I'm excited I've been able to be married to her this many years. But you see, you long for that day of marriage, and all of a sudden the stark reality of the two of you having to live together, and those things that you were free to do before you could no longer do, then all of a sudden God brings a child into your home, and then another child. And or when our dear daughter called one day, and they'd after three girls decide to try again for a boy, and she was discouraged somewhat because the doctor said there's not just one boy in there, there are two of them. Boy, that's changed her life. Or you're married and you anticipate the day the children will leave home and you can retire, and then you start to retire and realize, you know what, I thought all those years I have this built up, but the economy is going like it does. Or you have money in the stock market. See, you see, God forever does these things to lead you from one place of dependence to another. And somehow we become distraught and we say, why? But God does this, you see. Out of the release from captivity comes a cry in verse 4. God, restore our captivity. Somehow we thought it would be better than this, and it's not. Therein lies, my friend, the challenge of so much of us in life, as God moves us from one plane of dependence to another. God never wants to get us in that place where we don't need Him. Do you understand that? God wants us always to have, in fact, the matter is, we translate, give us this day our daily bread. There's no way to translate in English as it is, because it's give us this day the bread of today. If we don't even see God's provision for a month, I mean, you know, if somehow we're thinking rent is due in a month, we got it this month, and God, we're anxious because it's not going to be, we know, we got a month, we got to pay it again, and we don't have the money. God says, listen, you got a month to go. We don't want to have to be dependent upon God. It's not going to be dependent upon other people. We don't want to be dependent upon God. We don't like it. But God does it on purpose, because God wants us to bring us to the place where we come and we cry out to God, out of my release from captivity, I cry out for greater release. But now watch. Notice with that, there is added to this something, because there's a pattern. Once God releases us from this, there is a pattern that is followed. There's no doubt it's here. And it always happens. It doesn't matter where it happens. You can do three S's if you want. I'll come to three W's. You can have sowing, sorrowing, or supplication, but forget the three S's. We don't want those. Three W's. Notice, if you will, read in verse 5 and 6, and let me give you the overall summation. Those who sow work in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro weeping, carrying his bag of seed shall indeed come again with a shout of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. The very first thing, there is work, there is weeping, and there is waiting. You know, in fact, the matter is, when it says he who goes to and fro doing it, possibly better rendered, he who continuously does this. You know what? If we're going to get out of the problems we're in life, God, He can. Well, you know, God can do it. God can sit there and solve all those problems without anything happening, but it's not God's way, as a rule. Dependence upon God must be, but you see, there must be working. Notice this. He who sows in tears, verse 5, or he who carries his bag of seed in verse 6, see, you come back in this land and say, God, it's good to be here. And God, how come there are not crops growing in the field? He says, because the only way you get crops in the field is if you go and take the rocks away, if you till the soil, if you plant the seed, if you care for the crop. That's the only way it will happen, because that's how I designed it to happen. You have to work. You have to work. You have to work. Now, walk with me. Just go with me to Proverbs 6, since I like reading Proverbs so much. You go with me there, too. One of the great passages, by the way, and there's nobody in charge of them, but look at this, Proverbs 6, verse 6. Go to the ant, O sluggard. We don't like to think with that, but anyhow, observe her ways and be wise. Look at this. Proverbs 6 and verse 7, they have no chief, they have no officer, they have no ruler, and yet notice what happens. She prepares her food in the summer, gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. By the way, in an accompanying passage, which we won't turn to this morning, he talks about the sluggard, and the sluggard lies on his bed and says, there's a lion in the square. Now you know there's no lion there. Now, I've seen him in other places, but there's no lion. That's not the point. It's somebody who lies in bed, and then someone says, you know what, it's time to get up, and they think of all the reasons why they shouldn't get up. You know, it's too cold outside, there's a lion in the square. Or somehow, boy, there's too much to do, I better just stay here a little longer. Well, whatever the reason is, you see, we have this, and so he says, he like a door turns on his hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed and just turns over and says, you know what, I'm going to sleep this one out. You never make it, even in the kingdom of God, aside from work. It just doesn't happen. God's ordained it this way. Go with me, if you will, further. Proverbs chapter 28. Now we're going to go there and then come back. But Proverbs 28. Notice, if you will, verse 19. See, this is reminiscent of what they were facing here. He who tills his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty in plenty. Go back with me to chapter 27, if you will, in verse 8. Like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man who wanders from his home. And you see this kind of thing, you see just that sense of where it is. But keep going back with me. Chapter 21. Well, let's go to 20, if you will, start from 20. 20, verse 4. The sluggard does not plow after the autumn, so he begs during the harvest and has absolutely nothing. In 21, verse 5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. You see, the issue of all of this is you have to work. You have to work. There's no way out of this. You know, I think of people who look at situations. Let's take our country, for example. And it's nice, you know, we can pray as long as we want to, but I tell you what, you can pray and pray and pray. For example, you and I can sit here and pray that this community will be reached for Christ. Let me tell you, pray as long as you want to. If we don't get out there and do something, you say, well, how does this deal with the sovereignty of God? I understand that, but part of the motivation of this is somehow you're not going to see the results unless you do something. By the way, that was, you know, the loss of dear Art Craft, and everybody knows that. Every time we've moved to new facilities, as if God has us here, who are the unsaved people we're supposed to be reaching? That was his life. But you see, it doesn't just happen. We can get on our knees until the Lord comes back and pray for people to be saved. We need to do something to go out and share the gospel and minister to them. You think, for example, of church problems. Somehow we pray, God, just take these things away. You've got to do something. Churches that make it are churches where people are willing. And I'm not talking about working in so many different ways, but it is true. It doesn't matter what you want to see happen in church. You can't make it happen unless people are willing to work. That's why Paul, when he addressed his epistle to Thessalonians, first epistle, he says, you know, the things that impress me is your work that is produced by faith, your labor to point of fatigue produced by love, and your endurance that is produced by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. You can't make it in church without people to work. You can't make it without people to work the point of fatigue. I used to feel badly because some people, they work so hard, and you think, let's share this and make everybody do it. No, because you know what? Some people aren't going to do it. And you see, you need the people driven to do who will not quit. And so you have this. It just has to be. Look at a marriage. How do good marriages happen? They don't just happen. Any of you who know after years and years of walking with a partner, it took work. It took work. I say that, you know, it's true, and I've said it to some here. 10 years is great, but it's compared to what happens later. You can't even compare. 20 years was not, you know, I say it's the pits compared to where it is today. Somehow you see, but you see, marriage didn't become so exciting for us aside from an awful lot of hard work. Oh, did it? Worth it, but work. Children don't just grow up and happen to do, you see, without work. It doesn't happen. And people look and say, boy, look at their family. But you see, it takes work to get there. And you don't just sit and pray and say, God, may it happen. God puts it in perspective. You see, you need to go and work. It's the principle of God. You see, the pathway to blessing is a pathway of labor. It always is. Always is. Some of you will do as many of us did when it comes to exam time, and you're going to ask God to do for you what you know you don't deserve because you didn't work to get ready for the exam, but you're hoping that God will somehow oversee that and make sure that maybe you have answers you didn't even know you had. You see, the issue is you come to the end of it all. It's a principle of God. It just is a very strong principle. You need to work to get where you need to be. But you see, it's not depending upon yourself. It's still depending upon Him. Look at the other part that's in here, and you can't miss the truth of it either. You see, notice it's twice in here. Not only do you sow in tears. Not only do you go forth with your bag of seed, but you go forth weeping. Grown men, my friend, do cry. They do. I sit and read this and I reflect on the Father because it happened. When they came back from captivity and they sat at the table at night to eat together as a family, and they did. The Father sat there and He watched the children sitting at the table where they would cry out to the mother and say, you know, I'm hungry, I would still like some more. And you know it happened. You know that many a father who's worked all day in the field trying to make crops happen, that he can't make happen before God makes it happen. He's out there in the field working, he's working so hard, and he needs the food to nourish him, and yet he's concerned for his children. He's willing to sacrifice what he has for what they need. And therefore, without them knowing it, he makes sure that they have more on their plate. So a child will never say to his father, I'm hungry. And as he cries out to the mother, the father is crying in his heart because he knows there's nothing he can do outside of the intervention of God. There's nothing. When they came back from captivity, there was nothing he could do. There were no banks to borrow from. There was no store to buy it from. And I can see the Father out there doing what many of us would do, because there's no way at the table you'd sit and cry. But you're out there in the field far away from the house, and you know that nobody can see you. And your face is turned away from the house even at that, and you know but nobody can see, but you still make sure that nobody's going to have a chance to see. And all of a sudden, this big burly man lets himself do something he just doesn't normally do. And pretty soon you see the tears start to flow down from his eyes. The tears are caught up in his beard, and finally they drop into his sweat-soaked shirt, and he cries. Because he realizes, as hard as he works, there's nothing in the world he can do to resolve this problem outside of the help of Almighty God. And before God, with nobody else knowing, he weeps. He weeps. But then, notice, he's got to wait. You know, it's an interesting thing with this. I told Erin, this message was about her today. She sent her email out this week, and it was saying that God is teaching her patience. Just think about it for a while. Just how God does, see? Do you realize there's a pattern that God has created? Man didn't create it, God created it. Could God create a child overnight? He did. He created a woman overnight, did he not? Yes? Eve? Right? Are you with me? God can do it. Could God cause a woman, and there's no woman that really wants to go through 9 months of waiting for a baby, but that's how God's designed it. And could God cause a baby to come with, say, within 2 weeks? Could happen. God could do it with no weeks, right? I mean, God can do that. Can he not? With me here. Can God do that? The answer is yes, absolutely, right? Is God going to do that? Huh? The answer is what? Not a chance. It isn't going to happen. That's why Aaron waits. And we all wait. And we who are men don't understand Aaron's wait, but it's a tough wait. Because you've waited this long and somehow you want the baby to be born, and you just, the anxiety of all of this, but you see, God says you just have to wait. You see, you come back into the land and you need food, but you see, you've got to prepare the ground. You've got to plant the seed. God's got to send the heavy rains. God's got to send the light rains. They don't come a month apart. They come months apart. The corn doesn't grow overnight. You can read Jack and the Beanstalk if you want to, but you see, it doesn't happen, you see. Could God have done this? The answer is what? Absolutely, God could have done it. Does God do this? God doesn't do this, see. Because God created a way that man must work and a way that man must weep and a way that man must wait. You know, you wait in prayer and you wait in unbelievable patience for the hand of God to intervene. That's where they were. See, therein lies the pattern of blessing that God has established. He leads us from one place of dependence to another. Never, never, never outside of dependence upon him. You know that. The exciting thing for me in walking with many of you in this body is I've watched you walk from places where God has moved you from one point of dependence to another. And God has you now in a new state of dependence upon him for something totally different. And you work. And you weep. It is exciting because that's the way God works in the life of a person. It's the way that God works in the life of a family. That's the way that God works in the life of a church. It's the way that God works in the life of a nation. And this morning, we come to a time because we watch what God has done. And it is an exciting time. I come to the first three verses of this. And I rejoice because I see what God has done. I see a ministry that God has created. But God moves us from one place of dependence to another. I have an analogous situation in my mind, I think of, and I'm not saying that's why God's doing it. It is intriguing to me because God in his grace has seen fit to broaden the ministry of this body and has seen fit in the past to do unbelievable things. I will forever tell the story because I have not seen the likes. I've seen God provide, but not this way. When this body was young and we had a need of $19,000, somebody who had never even attended this body, someone who didn't even live in the state, called the church office and said, how do we transfer stock to the church? See, you can do that now because we learned how, because we did it for them, you see. Do you know what's interesting? They did not know the need. You didn't even know the need because we have not even brought the need to you that way. And yet the amount of the stock traded in was $19,000. When later they called again, sometime later, and they said, we'd like to transfer more stock. It was interesting again because it came out to be the same amount, less than the first time, but the amount that we needed again. And when he finally did come to visit this body after some 5 years, I went to him and I said, you know what? I said, what I appreciated was not even so much the gift, was the fact that God timed it the right way, and God gave us exactly what we needed each time. But you know, you walk through the wilderness for so long, and you see God providing the need with the manna, but all of a sudden you come to land, and the manna is taken away. See, God, can God give continually through somebody doing? He can. Does God always? He doesn't. And I have the feeling that God has brought us to a time where we look now and it's no longer the manna. It's for us to go till the ground and for us to work and for us to weep and for us to wait. I don't discuss finances. We're not even here primarily discussing that today. I'm going to preach the next few weeks from passages we've done just on levels of commitment that God calls us to. We are faced with an unbelievable challenge. It's exciting, though. We are working, by the way, on getting the webpage done, and it's about there, and people have worked awfully hard. But I did this conference just this last week. Two things came out of it. One was a couple that had transferred from here, or retired up to Montana from this area. And first thing they did is they called their son to Gura and says, you need to get over there and go to church, is what they did. But the other thing, they said, there just isn't Bible teaching up here. And therefore, I told them, in fact, this afternoon we're starting something which is one of the greater steps of faith that I've ever taken. It isn't tied into the finances of this body. But this afternoon we are starting to videotape some messages that we will be doing in front of a group of people, and we are going to be doing it because of the incredible need that people have. I was in a setting where there were church people who were asking for help. The fact is, let me just tell you something. This is what one of the deacons of the church said. Another deacon said, the pastor had come to town. There were 12 people in the church. He built the church up to 130, and this deacon basically ran him out of town. And his statement was, pastors come and go, but this is my church and I will always be here. Number one, it isn't his church. And when you talked about the fact it was God's church and here are these leaders taking it back, somehow how do they go back and communicate this to others? And so we're going to make videotapes so they can do that. We received an email this quickly after just being there. It says, my name is Pastor Joe Haney. We held a small IFCA conference here in Ulm, Montana this past week. We're right next to Tudot, it says. And he says, I mentioned some outlines and so forth. If there's any way I can review, buy, or download that data, we'd very much appreciate it and so forth. And goes on, so if you can help me, I'd sure appreciate it. We have unbelievable demands to do this, and God is opening doors of opportunity for us to be able to do. And why we're working on the internet is because we want to help pastors like this who, when they see the word taught, somehow want to do it that way. And we are trying by God's grace to prepare all of this. And it's exciting. Unbelievable days ahead.